Welcome to Keeping It Civil, a podcast co-sponsored by the School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership at Arizona State University and Arizona PBS. I'm Henry Thompson, a professor in the School of Politics and Global Studies at Arizona State University. This is an interview show in which I talk to scholars, writers, intellectuals, and thought leaders about civil discourse, the American political tradition, and intellectual life more broadly. I hope you enjoy the conversation. On this episode, I talk to Jennifer Frey, Dean of the Honors College at the University of Tulsa and a professor of philosophy and expert on moral psychology and virtue. We talked about her starting the new Honors College at the University of Tulsa and how she thinks honors education can address broader problems of higher education in America. Thank you very much, Professor, for joining us here at ASU for the annual conference of the School for Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
You're here for the annual spring conference, which is the big meeting, annual meeting of academics, community members, faculty here from ASU to talk about themes of civic education, leadership, and I believe you're giving a talk later on this morning.
I'm on a panel, so it's slightly less than a talk. But yes, I think the topic of our panel is whether or not there are tensions between liberal learning and civic education, how they might be overcome. If there are tensions, I don't think there are.
Okay, that's great. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But I wanted to ask you first about your new position, I believe, as the Dean of the Honors College at the University of Tulsa.
Yeah, so my career has taken an unexpected turn. Suddenly, I'm an administrator. I hope that I still am a philosopher, but I was faculty at the University of South Carolina. I wrote a lot about higher ed, and I was in conversation with various university presidents about, or I suppose I had entered the crisis of the humanities discourse. And the president of the University of Tulsa reached out to me after I was very strongly criticizing the University of Tulsa on Twitter. And he said, "Hey, we're not that bad. You should come visit us." And so I did. I gave a talk and he said, "I'm going to start an honors college." And I said, "Great. Sounds like a good idea. Good luck with that." And then he said, "I want you to be dean." And I was like, "Oh, I'm not interested in doing that. But thank you." And then about a year and a half later, they were announcing that I was dean. So he was very persistent and persuasive. And it was, I think, at the end of the day, an unrepeatable opportunity for me to have the chance to enact some of the reforms that I was advocating for and to, in a way, try to put theory into practice, which is always scary for a philosopher because we live in the realm of theory and we're very comfortable there. It feels very safe.
It's fascinating. So first of all, the recruitment by tweet, I'm glad you brought that up because I read about this on your Instagram page. Yeah. You have the local news story about this. I thought that was the perfect way to start the podcast, recruitment by tweet.
Yeah.
And by critical tweet.
Yeah.
So perhaps give the listeners a small brief background on what were you criticizing about the University of Tulsa at the time? And does it relate to this broader, as you said, crisis of the humanities?
It does. So in 2019, this is a previous administration. In 2019, the University of Tulsa decided more or less to murder liberal learning on its campus. And that involved completely restructuring the university, moving everyone who was basically in the humanities to a 4-4 load.
A higher teaching load for the faculty.
Higher teaching load. I mean, basically it was the complete marginalization of liberal learning and a very explicit relaunch of the University of Tulsa as a technical school. It would really focus on engineering, cybersecurity, public health, things like this, and really decentering things like philosophy and history and literature. They shut down their philosophy degree. And so as a philosopher, I...
You criticized them for that.
Yeah, I was not pleased with that decision. It goes well beyond my discipline. And I saw it as important because so much of the discourse thinks that the problem is merely material, right? Like somehow, if there were just enough money, the crisis would resolve. And that, to me, is a very blinkered view because the crisis is part of its money, but the money is actually secondary, I think, because it follows a cultural crisis, right? And a lot of it has to do with a loss of liberal learning, even within the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of utilitarian thinking that has colonized our universities, where the idea that you would study for the sake of the transcendentals, truth, goodness, beauty, that will get you laughed out of rooms, the eyes will roll, and it doesn't actually matter what discipline you're in. And so it's no surprise then that philosophy struggles for majors. But even math struggles for majors now. History struggles for majors. It's most fundamentally a crisis of education, an understanding of what higher education is. It's higher in cost. It's higher in opportunity cost. But in what sense is it meaningfully higher? If it's just an education for work, I would say it's not higher education at all. Higher education, traditionally, historically, was thought to be an education that makes you free. What sort of education is that, right? What are we talking about? If that's the kind of education that we're talking about, then history and philosophy and doing math for its own sake, you know, learning something about music, like this seems important because it somehow bears on human freedom or human flourishing. But if it's all about getting ahead, getting a job, satisfying your ambitions, satisfying your desires, if all we have is a model of consumer choice, right, where the consumeristic desires of the student dictate what the education is, because we just satisfy those desires, we're somehow like a business that meets those desires.
Right, of course.
Instead of forming people, which is actually our duty. So I just thought, well, if somebody wants to give me a modicum of power.
Right, to push back against.
And I can try to revitalize liberal learning. And let's just suppose, for the sake of argument, that it's successful and that people want to imitate it, then that seems like a really good thing to do. So that's ultimately why I decided to become an administrator, which was not, really wasn't in my life plan.
Well, it's not in the life plan of most faculty, actually. Yeah. It's sort of something that looms up at some point in many people's careers, I think, relatively unexpectedly, like for you. But let's rewind a little bit to 2019 at the University of Tulsa. They're making these reforms to downgrade liberal education, the arts and humanities, presumably also the social sciences were kind of getting dragged into that to a certain extent. That is not an unfamiliar story at all in higher education at the moment. What happened to those reforms? Were they implemented or did they drop them after some resistance?
Yeah, so what that administration didn't anticipate, and what probably no one would have anticipated, is the incredible pushback from alumni. And I think that speaks to the quality of the liberal learning that was actually taking place on that campus historically. To make a long and complicated story short, there's a new administration. That administration really wants to center liberal learning through the study of great books or classic texts.
So there's been a backlash that has led the university to take the diametrically opposed course to that which was proposed in 2019, it sounds like. And you're part of that new agenda.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what sort of initiatives are you undertaking at the Honors College quite concretely, and which have been more successful and which not so much?
So we're a startup, you know, we're very new. We have just completed our first semester. And what we're focused on is curriculum reform. So the University of Tulsa had an honors program. Every honors college in this country started out as an honors program launched in arts and sciences. And the same is true for the University of Tulsa. And so I inherited a curriculum that was kind of great booksy, but it wasn't maybe as systematic or integrated as it ideally could be. And so we've really focused on curriculum reform. We're putting together, here's how I would describe the curriculum in the Honors College. As an Honors College, we are focused on undergraduates, right? And we're focused on general education. And we want that to be interdisciplinary. Our motto is virtue, wisdom, and friendship. And so our curriculum is designed, like, very explicitly towards seeking those goals together in a unified way. So our core is a four-semester sequence of great books. We start with Homer, we end with Toni Morrison, and we look at the literary, philosophical, historical, and theological masterworks that have kind of shaped that tradition over the millennia. And we really focus on helping our students make connections and to see a kind of dialectic unfolding. Our classes are like this, a big table. We're all sitting around the table in conversation. The professor is not up giving a lecture and you're like busy taking notes. It's a very active, demanding kind of learning. Part of it is trying to find the arguments or concepts or ideas or images in the text and kind of tease out their meaning. But the biggest part of it is really trying to make sense of it in terms of a broader vision of reality, right? And trying to help students really try to see that bigger picture and to advocate it for it. So it's a kind of conversation, but it's a very high level sort of dialectical exchange. And the professor is really there to guide the conversation, maybe contribute to it in various ways, but not to dominate it, but also not to let other people dominate it. So a lot of what's happening there is a kind of formation, right? Where students are forming habits of mind, habits of thinking and reading and studying and making arguments, etc. But it's also habits of character, because when you are in conversation with another person, you actually need to have certain character traits for that conversation to go well. And so we really focus on kind of naming those and trying to help cultivate them within the seminar. Around that four-semester course sequence, we have honors courses. An honors course can be within any discipline, but an honors course needs to be seminar style. It needs to be active learning. It needs to be looking at foundations. And then we have a whole student life that is, or at least strives to be, an extension of our curriculum. It's an education that takes very seriously the idea that education is formation.
And tell me, how successful has it been? How's the uptake been among the students at Tulsa and by the broader university community?
So our retention rates and honors right now is like 99%. We just closed our application for next year and we got a truly record-breaking number of applicants to the Honors College. I would say that it so far is exceeding my wildest expectations for it. But again, I've been doing this for roughly 6 months.
So. Right. Congratulations. Let me ask a couple of questions though, because this model of sort of Oxford, Cambridge undergraduate education, right? We have very small groups,
yep.
Close reading of texts, very intense interaction between the faculty and the students in very small groups. This sounds like kind of the costly, labor-intensive type of higher ed that we're told is impossible in today's day and age because of cost. You have a too high a faculty-to-student ratio that just leads to very high cost. The students aren't prepared to pay the tuition that would be able to compensate the university for that type of faculty-student ratio, and it's just impossible to give that kind of education in today's world. How are you pushing past that?
So the president of my university created this Honors College as a priority, and he works with the CFO to set the budget. But look, every budget of any institution reflects that institution's priorities. Look, there's plenty of money, right? The question is, where is it going and why? These are questions about the good. These are questions about value. Of course, it's not impossible to really focus on teaching and liberal learning. It's just that many universities, for a variety of reasons, all of which I think are bad, are not doing it. That's the reality. Now, there are universities that are struggling. Let's just table them. And again, it goes back to, what is it that we think we're providing? Do we think we're providing whatever students happen to want when they're 18? Or are we providing something that we think is meaningfully a higher education? And what does that look like and why? Those are all questions of what it means to be a good human being and citizen, right? I mean, these are really big existential questions for universities.
But universities are facing other existential questions like declining enrollments system-wide that are leading to some universities going broke. You talked about the crisis of the humanities. I'd say there's maybe a broader crisis of the university at the moment than the crisis of the humanities might even sit within that. So I am interested to hear how you think that the sorts of programs that you're running can exist within this sort of environment where we are in a period of, I think, maybe ongoing fiscal consolidation or crisis at many universities, particularly public universities. And do you think that these sorts of programs that you advocate and are offering at Tulsa can be operated at scale at a public university like Arizona State or Michigan State or any other big public university? Do you think they can be offered at scale to a meaningful proportion of a university that big?
So I'm at a small R2 university, right? We have roughly 3,000 undergrads and a Division I. We have Division I sports or Division I football. I'm dean of an honors college. So that's the space in which I'm working. And what works for ASU, I think, is more complicated. Like, ASU is bigger than my hometown by a lot.
If you include all the online students and things, I think, yeah, you get to a pretty big number.
Yeah. But of course, ASU has an honors college. I don't think that there's something that I often say to people is that there's no like quick fix to any of this. Universities need to look at their own situation, their own traditions, their own resources, etc. But I do think that universities need to rethink general education. And part of that rethinking of general education should be to really reflect deeply about what general education is supposed to be doing in higher ed. General education at most schools has become a very incoherent, watered down sort of thing. I think that's a huge problem, right? And so part of that conversation needs to be really reinvesting in general education, having our best professors teaching general education classes, which almost never happens, right? General education is like for grad students to teach, right? I mean, that's kind of the mentality.
The most elite research faculty normally want to be teaching graduate students, right? PhD right. students and advising PhD students because they feel that's where their highest value add is.
Yeah, and so this is something that I've written a lot about is kind of how general education becomes sort of malformed within the research model. Now, I'm not saying that we should give up the research model. I've done plenty of research, and I don't want to give that up. However, I do think that we need to double down more on undergraduate education. And a huge part of that is gen ed and making gen ed something substantive and systematic and civic, especially at our public universities, right? The recognition that a higher civic education, an education for self-government in the fullest sense, is absolutely necessary to the common good of the state. So the state has an interest in funding it. The state has an interest in making sure that it really is, right, geared towards self-government in the strongest sense, and making sure that universities aren't neglecting it.
So do you think that this is one sort of avenue where the sort of education you're advocating can reach the broad masses, even at a big public university, is through some sort of compulsory general education and civics course offerings?
All gen ed is compulsory. Right. I mean, that's just kind of how gen ed functions, right? These are the classes that the University of Arizona says you have to take. It doesn't matter what you're going to major in. The only question is, what kind of education are we really trying to impart to any student, regardless of what they go to specialize in? And I think at really large institutions, really large R1 state flagship schools, like the school that I was previously at, the University of South Carolina, which I think has roughly, 30,000 undergrads, it's really hard to bring faculty together to work on general education, in part because they've been trained not to care, which is not their fault, and in part because it's such a Herculean task, which is why I think the best place to kind of try to work this out and model it is, say, in an honors college or in a special program. That way, there are successful models to imitate, right? When we think about reform in higher ed, I think it's best to start small and see what progress you can make, see what works, and then expand from there. And I actually think that honors education is the place to start. I mean, people forget, or they never knew, that honors education, which is a uniquely American phenomenon, really started very explicitly on this Oxbridge model, right? So think about the Columbia Corps, like the famous Great Books Corps at Columbia. That was originally called the Honors Program. The first Honors Program was at Swarthmore, and it was started by a Rhodes Scholar who came back and wanted to bring that style of education, this kind of humane letters, study of classic texts in a small environment, wanted to bring that back to the U.S. It's really about bringing honors education back to its historical roots, because I think most honors colleges today don't have any emphasis on liberal learning, don't have any emphasis on classic texts, don't have any emphasis on that kind of very small seminar-style model of exchange, and are not so much focused on formation, but are focused on the things that universities like are typically focused on now, right? Like honors, awards, kind of external goods. And there's a neglect of that internal formation. External, like, look, awards are great. I'm not against awards, but the purpose of your study isn't to get them.
One thing that strikes me is that, you know, the Oxford model that I taught in myself for a few years when I was over there at Oxford is there's so much self-directed learning in the Oxford model, right? You meet with your tutor once a week for like 20 weeks a year because the terms are so short, and the rest of the time you're just working on your own in the library. I guess that leads to a certain character formation.
Yes, there is, but I mean, you've got this combination. That's sort of like the pure Oxford model.
Yeah, of course.
Which I think is unrealistic for most schools.
I think it's also only achievable in Oxford because they have these huge endowments and things that they can pay the professors.
Yeah. Again, I'm more of a fan of the small seminar.
How does this type of pedagogy or instruction in an honors college relate to ability? Can all students enjoy this type of education to the same degree, or can only really the smart and the smartest students benefit from it the most? And I say this as someone who himself has sat in seminars and not said much because there were three or four way smarter people than me in the room and they just dominate the conversation with the professor. It's a combative or competitive, difficult environment to engage in if you're not at the very elite level intellectually, I think.
I think any human activity can become combative or competitive. We're really good at doing that. And I think that's the role of the professor in that space, is to prevent that from happening. Because if your learning becomes an expression of what St. Augustine called the libido dominandi, right, this will to dominate other people, then it's already become deformed, right? Because wisdom's a common good. I'm not trying to beat you in the wisdom game. Now, lots of students are, but that's because they don't actually understand what their education is for. And they don't see the seminar as a space of intellectual friendship because they haven't been taught to see it that way. They haven't experienced any kind of pedagogy that helps them to experience it in that way. They don't even probably understand the concept of a common good. And they see everything as a means to their ambition. And honestly, almost especially in honors colleges, where you have the most kind of elite striving students, you really, to me, you have to fight against that. And you have to get them to see that actually wisdom begins in humility. You're not going to progress in this space if you think that you've got it figured out and your job is to get everyone to agree with you. But then also, you know, part of that is recognizing that other people have something to add to the conversation, that in terms of your own progress, it is bad to dominate the conversation. And, you know, this, I mean, for some students, this is less of a problem than for others, but for all of them, you are trying to get them to see that we are learning from one another, right? The goal is not to be the best. The goal is to try to reflect and think about these transcendentals, right? And to do it together. That's all we're trying to do.
Do you have issues, though, simply with preparation and understanding of these texts? I mean, when I was talking about the competitiveness of seminar setting, that you address that in one sense, but on another sense, not every student is going to have the same ability to engage with and understand every text for every session, right? So I guess what I'm asking is this model of education inherently elitist, that only the elite at any university are going to be able to engage in this sort of seminar? Or do you think that everyone can enjoy it?
So a book that I highly recommend is called The Intellectual Lives of the British Working Class. It's quite a big book, but it's really worth it. People who actually have studied the history of the so-called Great Books movement know that the working class have been hugely involved in it historically, and that to this day, programs in Great Books that are explicitly geared towards very vulnerable populations are life-changing. They are life-changing. And the problem that you raise is a problem for any class. It's a problem for organic chemistry. Not everybody's good at it. That's why it's a weeder class. But the real difference between the way that, say, organic chemistry is taught and what we're doing in the Honors College, and both have a role in the university, and I'm not saying that they don't, but the goal in organic chemistry is to just learn these skills and understand these fundamentals and to be able to do the problems. You got to get an A on that test, or you at least have to get above a 75, right? If you're going to continue in your pre-med track. That's not really how the honors seminar works, right? Because if you look at our assignments and our model of assessment, so we do a lot of journaling, we do oral exams, we have participation is a huge part of the grade. We do essays, but the goal of the essay isn't sort of like to produce Wissenschaft, right?
Which means science in
German. Which is like kind of a scholarly work, right? It's really just about trying to evaluate the argument and draw something out of it. There's a lot of room in that space for individual expression. And also you can see growth in a student, which is the most important thing that you want to see. Now, does everyone get an A? Absolutely not. Is that true for every class? Yes. Will some students not thrive in college? Yes. But this has nothing to do with anything unique to this kind of pedagogy. It's anywhere.
So it seems like the Honors College is going gangbusters, as we would say where I'm from.
Yeah.
Do Americans say that? Gangbusters? Would you say that?
I've heard it, sure.
You've heard it? Sure. Yeah. Okay, good. No need to translate. What next for the Honors College at Tulsa?
So writing lots of grants. We are starting what I call my Great Book Summer Camp, but it's officially called the Honors Summer Academy. It's for rising sophomores, juniors, and seniors, so high school students. And they come and they live in our dorms and they experience our seminars in the morning. And then the rest of the day they spend with Honors College students who are also living in the dorms and sharing meals with them. And they do like fun stuff with them. And then we have some workshops and things also in the afternoons, evenings, trying to help them figure out how to write a college essay, et cetera. So I'm excited about that. We're going to do that every summer, and hopefully it'll just get bigger and bigger every year.
Let's pivot real quick and talk about this other string you have to your bow, which is your podcast.
Yeah, I'm a podcaster too.
Yeah, you're a much more experienced and professional and capable podcaster than I am. Tell me about your podcast.
So I'm an accidental podcaster, just like I'm an accidental dean. I had this three-year multi-million dollar research project, which ran from roughly 2015 to 2018. And it was titled Virtue, Happiness, and Meaning in Life.
Is that the same as the Honors College motto or slightly different?
It's not the same, but it is adjacent. That's for sure. Because my professional background is in virtue ethics. Anyway, it was this essentially interdisciplinary thing. And we got near the end of the grant. I got this phone call like, you have like $400,000 that you haven't spent. And I was like, really? That's surprising.
You could have bought, could you buy a boat or something with
no.
Them? No boat.
You cannot do that. We were like, gosh, we need to spend some money. And I thought a podcast would be a good way to spend money, which is actually not true at all.
No, it doesn't cost anything at all.
But I didn't know.
It doesn't cost anything at all, yeah.
No, so.
That's the great thing about it.
I know. It's extremely naive. So I was like, well, you know, I was throwing some ideas out. One of them was a podcast. And
so what happened to the money if you didn't spend it on the podcast?
So I think, I mean, with any grant, if you don't spend the money, I think it goes back to the, you know, the foundation. But my university really did not want that to happen.
Yes.
They wanted to keep it. So anyway, we spent the money, really the podcast was very cheap.
Okay, I'm not going to ask any more questions about the money. I get the message, all right.
So I started this podcast. It was 2018. I don't remember how many episodes I did, maybe 10. And then the grant was over and I thought the podcast was over. Then one day I got a phone call from a friend of mine who runs the Institute for Human Ecology at CUA. And he's like, hey, what happened to your podcast? And I'm like, well, I mean, I just stopped doing it. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because I don't have any more money. Like, it was part of a grant. And he was like, oh, that's too bad. He's like, so you're just not going to do it? And I'm like, no. And he said, well, what if we funded it? And I was like, okay. So then they started funding it. Now the University of Tulsa funds it.
What are the key themes or topics that you cover?
Yeah, so the podcast is called Sacred and Profane Love. You should subscribe. It's a literature, philosophy, and theology podcast. I use this quote from Iris Murdoch in the about section of the podcast. It basically says, art is an attempt to overcome the self and see the world. So basically the idea is to look at great works of literature through the lens of how reading them, how the experience of reading them can help us think more deeply about love, happiness, and meaning in life, and also how practices of reading great works of literature can actually shape us on a deeper level. So kind of changing our vision, and that great literature is a kind of moral endeavor. Yeah, so we just have unscripted conversations, and I really love it. It's so much fun. I just relaunched the podcast. Season 5 just relaunched last week, and my first episode of season 5 was with the political theorist Patrick Deneen. And I wrote to him and I said, hey, what do you want to talk about? And he said, let's talk about Jalil's White Noise, which is like a postmodern novel. And I was like, wow, that seems off brand. I wouldn't have expected you to choose that. Then sitting down and talking with him for an hour about why he loves this book, what is the value of reading this book, you know, what does Delilah have to do with the Tocqueville, for example? It just was such a wonderful, rich, surprising, rewarding conversation. So that's basically all we do on the podcast.
That's great. You know, I conclude every interview by asking our guests for a suggestion of a podcast or a book or a film or something that they should listen to. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to ask that today. I'm instead going to give a recommendation of my own, which is that our listeners should go out and listen to the podcast Sacred and Profane Love and hit subscribe.
Yeah, thank you.
So thank you very much for being here. I think we've reached the end of our time. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for visiting ASU. I hope you have a great rest of the conference and rest of your visit. And thank you very much, Professor Frey, for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.